towards hatred or towards cruelty. And again, this is with mind, body, and speech. Getting infatuated with another person or with material things. Like you go to a person that's very, very poor right now, and all they think about is how nice it would be to get rich. But they don't put any action behind it. They just dwell in their imagination and don't do anything. That's unwholesome. Their mind gets caught with desire and want for everything that's out there. And that causes a lot of problems. Now, the imagining of enmity means somebody did something you don't like, caused you a lot of pain and a lot of suffering, and that means you hold them in your mind and hate them and wish them all kinds of painful things. Now, the cruelty is seeing yourself getting even. And dwelling on getting even. Revenge. There's three wholesome kinds of motivation. The motivation through renunciation, through non-hatred, non-cruelty. Now, every now and then I talk with some women will come to me and they'll tell me some horror story about something that happened to them in the past, about getting raped or getting beat up or something like that. How can they practice renunciation? Their mind is very hard. Their mind is very confused because of past things that happened to them. A lot of fear, a lot of anxiety, these kind of things. How can they practice renouncing those kind of states? By practicing loving kindness through forgiveness. Forgiving themselves, forgetting the other person for causing them pain and not understanding. It's not an easy path, but it is the healing path. And when you do that, you let go of the hatred. And you let go of the want to get even. Just not worth it anymore. That's how we can get past these major traumas that can happen in our life. I mean, a person does something that's really bad and you don't like it. It can be physical or mental. It can have something to do with your job, or it can have something to do personally with your life. But there's a lot of problems with that. You have to learn how to renounce your attachment and practice forgiving so that you don't have any more hatred and you don't have the desire to get even with that no good so-and-so. Okay, there's three kinds of unwholesome perception: sensuality, enmity, and cruelty. Perception is an interesting thing. What does perception mean? It's recognition. Now, it's a little bit more than that. Let's say I have a Coke bottle here. Your perception sees the color and form, and recognition that this is a bottle, and memory. Seeing the name Coke on there, this is a Coke bottle. There's Coca-Cola inside. So it has to do with all three of these. Okay? Now, if you don't have the memory attached to it, then it just stays color and form. It was an interesting thing. At one time, the Indians down in South America, Tierra del Fuego, that's right down at the tip of South America, the Europeans started coming around with boats, and they could look out at the ocean and they couldn't see the boats. Their perception was that it was just part of the ocean. But one of the holy men, whose perception was a little bit sharper, said, "Oh no, you see there's the mast right there, and there's a different color there, and that is a boat." And at first, when they couldn't see the boat, they were shocked that these white men were coming onto the land. They didn't know where they came from. They thought it was from thin air, because their perception was, when they got on the land, they were men because they recognized them. But when they were in the boat, they didn't see the boat. It wasn't part of their perception. It was just part of the horizon. But when the holy man started telling them how to recognize, then everything started to make sense. And then their memory really held that, so they weren't shocked by the white man coming onto the shores anymore. So you have perception is seeing the color and form, and then recognizing that color and form is this, and then what that represents from memory. Okay, now we have three kinds of unwholesome perception: sensuality, enmity, and cruelty. Three kinds of wholesome perception: renunciation, non-enmity, and non-cruelty. And we've gone through this quite a bit. I'm gonna head on a little bit faster than this now. There's three kinds of wholesome elements or unwholesome elements. Okay. What are elements? What's an element? David? Okay. That's getting closer. It means the makeup, what things are made up of. Now, when the Buddha was talking about four elements, the earth element, the fire element, the air element, the water element, that's what everything that's physical is made up of. Actually, there's a couple more. There's light and space. There's six elements. But it just means parts, basically. When you have sensuality, enmity, or cruelty, the elements tend towards making mind tight and heavy. And when you have wholesome elements, they tend towards making your mind light and alert and quick to recognize. Three more elements: the element of sense desire, the element of form, the element of formless. Yes.
No.
No, this is a different kind of thing. These three are basically unwholesome. The element of sense desire. Let's see what it says back here, just for the fun of it. That means the world is of sense pleasure. The element of where'd it go? Well, the form is rupa, is the bodily element, the body, the physical body. The formless means the mental realm. No, not really. When you talk of the aggregates, they can be affected by clinging. These are affected by craving. And there's a slight difference there. Yeah, the formless is the mental realm, right? Yeah. Now, let's see. Now we have three more elements. The element of form, formless, and the element of cessation. Now, this is what we're starting to get to when we were talking about nothingness. Okay? These three elements are, the element of form is the element of being reborn in Devaloka or Brahmaloka. The formless is being reborn in the high Brahmalokas. And the cessation is Nibbana. Now, there's three more elements. The low element. The low element meaning the coarse. The coarse thoughts, the coarse feelings, all of these kind of things. The middling element is the development of meditation. And the sublime element, Pandita Dhatu, okay. The sublime element is the Arupa Jhanas and the Nibbana. Now there's three kinds of craving. Sensual craving, craving for becoming, craving for extinction. Craving for sensual pleasures. I like seeing. That's the craving for seeing. Hearing, tasting, touching, thinking, smelling. The craving for becoming. Now the craving for becoming is commonly called desire. That pulls you out of the present moment and puts you into your imagination. You don't see what's happening right here and right now. The craving for extinction, that's the craving for things to stop happening. That has a form of dislike in it. You suffer so much you want everything to stop. You don't want it around anymore. That's a craving for extinction. Some people they commit suicide because of that craving for extinction. They want it to stop. Now, all of these are unwholesome states because they pull you out of the present moment. What? There is no such a thing as craving for Nibbana. Not really. There is the key word here is craving. Okay, craving means I want. The desire for Nibbana to occur can be a wholesome desire without I or any attachment to it. See the difference? Okay, there's three kinds of craving. Craving for the world of sense pleasures, that means being reborn as a human being. Craving for the world of form, that means being reborn as a human being or a deva. Craving for the formless. The formless world is the arupa jhanas. The formless world is the the realm of not having a physical body anymore. Now there's five, nine realms like that. You know what? I was going to make a chart, and I didn't do it. Try to remind me to make a chart of all of the 31 planes of existence. Three more kinds of craving. The world of form, the world of formless for cessation. As for 14. Well, we've gone through that enough. Three fetters. Fetters means attachments. Of personality belief, of doubt, and this one. It says attachment to rite and ritual, but that's not right. The wrong belief in rite and ritual. And that makes a major difference. Now, what is a personality belief? That means taking everything personally as yours. All thoughts, all feelings, sensations, everything. When you do that, it causes your mind to tighten around things. And you don't see how things arise and pass away by themselves. So the personality belief is a wrong belief. In Pali, they call it anatta. An means no. Atta means self. Now, I was just reading a Hindu book, and in this Hindu book, it was very interesting the way this man was describing the difference between the little self and the big self. In other words, the difference between me and God. But what he described as being God is consciousness. Everything has consciousness. So that means God is in everything. This is a belief in self, in something that is permanent, always like that, always the same. And that's how people, Hindus in particular, start talking about reincarnation. Because there's that big self, that consciousness that's always there. And it happens from one lifetime to the next lifetime to the next lifetime. It's permanent. God is permanent. Yeah? Dharma body? I don't know what the Dharma body is. I don't know what that means. Can you help me? That you're getting a lot into philosophy when you're starting to talk about those kind of bodies. And the Buddha in the Nikayas was not so much into philosophy as he was into this is the way it really works. This is the way it really is. You can say, well, the Buddha's teaching is the Dhamma body. But the Buddha's teaching, he said, will last for about 5,000 years and then it will fade. That doesn't mean the truth isn't still the truth. It means that it's not going to be recognized anymore. The real thing about a Buddha being born, or Bodhisattva being born and becoming a Buddha, is that they've gone through so many lifetimes of purifying themselves that their mind is very, very intelligent. And they can see Dhamma and how it works. They don't make the truth. They just rediscover the truth, and then they tell everybody else about it. The truth is always there. Now, because the truth is always there, that means everything is suffering, everything is impermanent, and there is no permanent self or soul. There's no personality. There's only these three characteristics in everything. But it takes a Buddha to be able to recognize that, because there's a long period of time when the Buddha era is not around anymore. And there's a lot of delusion and a lot of wrong belief that occurs. Over and over, and lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes. We are so lucky to be born in a Buddha era. I mean, this is it's phenomenal luck to be born so close to the time of a Buddha. I mean, he's only 2,500 years away. Compared to the millions and millions and millions of lifetimes that we might have to live, arise and pass away, before we have another opportunity to see a Buddha. This is, yeah, I've talked about taking a Bodhisattva vow and why I don't think it's a good idea right now. We're in a Buddha era. We have the teachings in reasonably good shape. We need to follow those teachings to the end so that we can get off the wheel of samsara, so we don't have to put up with so much pain and suffering and dissatisfaction over and over and over again until we can be reborn during another Buddha era and then wake up. We're so phenomenally lucky. I mean, I can't tell you. I heard a monk start talking about how truly fortunate it is to be born at this time. That's why I became a monk. Look at how fortunate we are to be born during the time of the Buddha. His teaching is still reasonably strong right now. We still have a fairly good description of his teachings. Don't waste it. Another reason that I became a Buddhist monk was because my teacher gave a talk on how many times the Buddha was actually a monk before he became a Buddha, and he was a monk only 9 times in all of his millions and millions of lifetimes. He was only a Buddhist monk. He was only a monk 9 times. This is a precious thing that we have right now. And it's so easy to get caught up and forget it because the world is going so fast. the advantages of practicing the Buddha's path and being able to see how you cause your own pain and how to let go of that pain so your mind can be calm and open and relaxed and peaceful. These are the teachings of the Buddha. How to do that? Practice. Nothing is unchanging. Nothing is unchanging. Everything is impermanent. Every conditioned thing is impermanent. It's a form of suffering. And there is no self. The only thing that is unconditioned is Nibbana. Everything else is conditioned. Because I just made it, it's changed, hasn't it? It was there, and now it's not there. Even saying it means that it is impermanent. Everything... I suppose you could say the only permanent thing is impermanence, but that doesn't mean anything. But it takes a Buddha to recognize that truth and to tell us about it. That truth is always going to be around, you're right. Impermanence, the fact of impermanence is always there. Everything is always changing. So you can say the truth of impermanence is permanent, but it's not really, because we don't always see it. Okay? We have to be able to see it for it to be the truth. And the only time we can see it is when a Buddha comes around and says, hey, look at that. We don't see it otherwise. You can say, well, suffering is always permanent. It's not always permanent. There is a cessation of suffering. And you can't say, honestly, you can't say that impermanence is permanent, because Nibbana is there. You can say all conditioned things are impermanent, and that would be correct. But you can't say all things, because you have Nibbana. And we're getting into semantics, which is real fun, but it's a philosophy. Okay, where did we go? Oh, personality belief. Okay, now when we talk about doubt, doubt means the perplexity of mind about whether this is the correct path or not. The last part of this, when it says attachment to rites and rituals, I've changed the word attachment to wrong belief in rites and rituals. The wrong belief in rites and rituals means that belief that if you do a rite or a ritual, that you will attain Nibbana by doing that. Rites and rituals, although they can be real fun, don't directly lead to Nibbana. you have to have what? And what is right view? Okay, where's the attachment there? Okay. But there has to be understanding. You can't get there without understanding. And the understanding is what? Everything is impersonal. Seeing everything as part of a process. Seeing directly how dependent origination works. Now, dependent origination is a real interesting thing. And there's a lot of people that spend a lot of time memorizing it forwards and backwards and all different ways that they can. And you don't have to know dependent origination at all. All you have to do is practice the meditation. You will see it. If you don't recognize it, when your first experience of Nibbana occurs, you will see all of the steps of dependent origination coming up in order. You'll see it. You don't have to know it. That's what happened to the Buddha when he became enlightened. All of a sudden, he saw dependent origination. How it arose, how it passed away. Because of dependent origination, it's seeing the process under a microscope. Then all of these other philosophies just kind of fade away. Now, the Buddha talked at one time, Ananda, who had become a Sotapanna by listening to the Buddha give a Dhamma talk, and his understanding, all of a sudden, his understanding got so straight and so true that he became a stream enterer. Now, there's two kinds of stream enterer. There's two kinds of every step of enlightenment. There's the path, that means experiencing the path, and the fruition of becoming a stream enterer. How does the fruition occur? Now, you've already had the experience of Nibbana. You've seen dependent origination one time. Sometime in the future, you'll be doing something. And all of a sudden, the fruition, when the conditions are right, the fruition starts to occur. And you'll stop what you're doing, you sit down, there's the cessation of perception and feeling, short period of time. And then there's the seeing of dependent origination again, in more detail. Instead of seeing just one factor arising and passing away, you see it happen two times. This is not the end, this is not the completion of the fruition. This will happen three different times. It can happen all in one sitting, or it can happen spaced out over time. When you see four times all of the factors of dependent origination, your mind has a major change occur. And that is the experience of fruition. And that's how it arises. It says, it describes it very nicely in the Samyutta Nikaya. It's the unconditioned state. It's beyond anything that has condition at all. In the Anguttara Nikaya, It's described like this. You go to the beach and you make a sandcastle. Every grain of sand is in exactly the right place. And then a wave comes and it washes it away. All of those grains of sand are still there, but they're not held together anymore. And you can't take those grains of sand and make exactly the same sandcastle again. We have five aggregates, and these are held together by craving and ignorance. When we let go of the craving and ignorance, there's nothing to hold these five aggregates together again. And that's what parinibbana is. That's just these aggregates just dissipate, and it can't be put back together again. There is no more craving. There is no more ignorance. No ignorance at all. Boy, that's a tough one. I don't know what original means in this context, because original means that there's a condition, and this is going to an unconditioned. That's philosophy. And just your saying that you were a Buddha means that that's a condition. And Nibbana means unconditioned. There's no more conditions at all. There's no way to even talk about it, because everything that we say is conditioned. How you hear what I'm saying right now is a condition. How can we describe it? There was one time there was a frog that jumped into a lake and ran across a fish. And the fish says, "Oh, I haven't seen you for a while. Where have you been?" And the frog said, "Well, I've been out on the land." And the fish said, "Land? What does that mean?" Well, the frog didn't quite know how to answer that. And he said, "Well," the fish started asking him some questions. "Can you swim on this land?" "No, you can't swim in the land." Do you breathe through the gills in the land?" "No, I don't breathe through the gills." "Then land is nothing." So the frog said, "Fine, it's nothing. I'm going to go back to it again." Jumped out of the water. But it was beyond the fish's experience, and he asked all the kinds of questions that didn't relate to what land is. You can't swim through it. It's solid. What? Well, it means that it's just beyond our experience to be able to be talking about it. You have to experience it to see what it is. Well, but there's a different way of the word. I'm talking about parinibbana, and you're talking about still being an arahat. Okay, we're talking about different things again, and then it gets tricky. But when you would die, there is no more becoming. And what does that mean? You say going back to your original nature, but that is part of a condition. And it's unconditioned. No, I got into physics at one time very, very strongly for just trying to be able to explain what Nibbana was. Now, Nibbana literally means putting out of the fire. It means no more heat. The Buddha called any kind of craving or attachment or any kind of thing like that burning. What's burning? The eye is burning. The eye consciousness is burning. Everything about the eye is burning. The color and form is burning. What's it burning with? It's burning with craving. Now, when your mind becomes very calm and you go beyond seeing consciousnesses arise and pass away, there is still some fire there. There's still some craving that's still there. There's ignorance. Nibbana is the lack of all fire. It's the lack of all heat. If there's any light at all, there's heat. So that's completely beyond any kind of light and any kind of heat. Now, when you get to certain stages, you can see very, very clearly how craving arises. First there's heat, and then there's light. Nibbana is the lack of that. It's beyond that. Don't know how to describe it. It's tough. Yeah. No, that's a condition. Joy is a condition too. Now there, they call it the bliss of Nibbana. The happiness that occurs of Nibbana, but that's because we don't know how to describe it outside of that. We don't have words that can describe it. Because there is no condition, there's no holding together of anything. Beyond emptiness by a lot. But it's not nothing. It's not nothing. It just doesn't work. Now, the nothingness, as I understand it, that is trying to be attained by people that are in the Mahayana, it is the nothingness of not self. Huh? The emptiness is no ego attachment. But that doesn't mean that there's not something else. I mean, when you let go of ego attachment, you can still have a body, but you're not attached to it anymore. It's still seeing, there's still a process that occurs, but there's no attachment to that process. But what is weightless? It's real difficult to talk about this kind of thing because it's just so far beyond any kind of understanding until you have the experience. And even when you have the experience, it's just like the frog talking to the fish. You just can't describe it. But it's beyond that. It's beyond an egoless state. Because you can be egoless and still have five aggregates. Well, it all happens that way. There's not any attachment that can be there. That just by nature, the experience of Nibbana is beyond any kind of ignorance at all. And